Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm with Bo Caldwell, CFP, and Chuck Price, founder and author of Investing Simplified, the book, and the number one bestseller, Your Retirement Made Simple. Chuck Price has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investing in retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America with a financial advisor, and now a CFP, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and comes to you live from Portland, Oregon, on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. You can contact Bo or Chuck by visiting pfgwm.com. Or you can email them with a question at ask@pfgwm.com. Or you can call them right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. And for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
Welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're listening today, thank you for joining us. Just as a reminder, we do play the show live online at investingsimplifiedradio.com, as well as rebroadcast our show via podcast wherever you get your podcasts. That's iTunes, Apple Music, Google Play. If you do listen via podcast, please do leave a review on there for us. It helps just boost our numbers so we know who's listening and where to get that content out to you. I'm Bo Caldwell, CFP, and with me in studio today is Kevin Stege, Baker Colson, CPA firm. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Bo.
And Taylor Cattell with AKG Law Group is in today. Hello, Kayla. Taylor.
Good morning.
I just called you Kayler.
It happens.
Sometimes in the morning, you know, my brain just doesn't function. The synapses aren't properly firing. Things aren't connecting.
I don't see a coffee mug over on your side, though.
Right. I should have brought... I didn't bring the coffee and just the water. I had somebody tell me one time that water is just as effective as coffee, and I kind of scoffed at him, but...
That's worth a scoff.
Yeah.
Water in conjunction is a good idea,
right,
though.
Right. Well, dehydrate with the coffee and then rehydrate with the water, right, is the important thing, I think. So we've had kind of a, you know, by the standards of, you know, what we've had over the last 5 or 6 months, this week has been fairly benign in terms of the market. It's been sort of bouncing around a little bit up and down, but not big moves. We've kind of gone away from, you know, traditionally this year we've had more, you know, 1% or more moves in the market on a daytime, both up and down, than we've had in a long time. And it feels like it's gotten really, really choppy. But then, funny enough, with all the, you know, the political strife that's going on and all the noise that you're hearing in Washington, the market hasn't moved as much. It's been sort of bouncing around, but there are small movements and little movements like that. So it's kind of interesting to watch that with the market. We've touched all-time highs again, and we keep touching them again and again. I know Chuck was on a couple weeks ago on his, and I'm using air quotes here, his farewell show, because we all know that he's got stuff to say and it's not going to be vacating the prem for long. But he has his prediction for next year of double-digit returns, and I think that that's not outside the realm of possibility. That, you know, there are economists that I follow that I've been listening to that say that we have another 3 or 4% to go up this year, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. I think in reality, I think that that's something that is not necessarily going to happen. But there's a lot of scuttlebutt, for lack of a better term. There's a lot of attention out there being paid to what's called a secular bull market. And what that means is, a lot of people think about a bear market and a bull market. So bear is bad, right? For those of you who don't know, bear is when the market touches 20% down from its most recent high, that's considered a bear market, right? We had that last year. It touched 20% down in December. And then what happens traditionally, a lot of people think about a bear market or the market going down, they think about a recession. That's the big word that you hear bounced around, especially considering everyone's got a little bit of PTSD from 2008 and they're thinking, you know, global recession, and they think of, you know, a financial crisis. But having a recession, which I think is in the offing in the next couple of years, is not necessarily the worst thing ever, particularly for your investments. Most recessions traditionally are very short, especially in what's called a secular bull market. So what that means is, even though we're going to have these 20% pullbacks, and they should happen more frequently than they have happened over the last 10 years, that the market still ends up higher. And that's what the term secular bull market means. And I think that that's really something that is, I think that's really a possibility. Again, you know, the market does one of three things, right? It goes up, it goes down, or it stays the same. But I really think that there's a lot of inertia that's built up to doing that, to continue to drive the market higher. Companies have a lot of cash on the sidelines. When we had the financial crisis a couple years ago, a big part of it was the housing market and the housing debt, and then the reinsurance and the double debt on that. You know, everyone's seen that the Christian Bale movie, that The Big Short. There's all those things that went into that, and a lot of those have been regulated out. But the other thing is companies and corporations were borrowing a lot. They were highly leveraged in 2008. It was very similar to what happened in the dot-com bubble in 2000, where all these companies were, their balance sheets, if Kevin had come in and looked at their balance sheets, he would have been like, don't invest here, because they're just doing funny money stuff. But they're, you know, a lot of them are saying, hey, we're worth all this money, but they didn't have any cash. They didn't really have any assets. They had a lot of debt, and they had a lot of stock price, but they didn't really have any assets, right? They had a lot of equity and a lot of debt. And so these companies now are carrying a ton of cash. Apple is holding on to just gobs of cash, which is there for deployment and investment. And so when these pullbacks happen, or when these, you know, opportunities for buying come up, these companies do have that money available. And the cost of lending, you know, interest rates are still insanely low compared to, you know, historical interest rates. And so the cost of borrowing and reinvestment in your company, if you needed to borrow that, you need to borrow rather than having cash, is really still really low too. So there, you're going to see red flags out there. And if you do, if you, yeah, I had this question the other day, if, you know, what do you watch in the morning? Don't watch the news, because you're going to hear, you know, crazy, tune in now to see what's going to happen. Is this the end of the world? You know, and then they come back and they don't even talk about it anymore, because they just wanted you to tune back in. But when you're watching CNBC, or if you're watching Fox Business, or if you're watching these different business channels, Bloomberg and what have you, they're not telling you exactly what they think. You know, they don't have economists on that, you know, are reasonable. They have people on that are doom and gloom. They're either, you know, super excited about market's going to go straight up, or the market's going to go straight down, mm-hmm. because it drives ratings. And the biggest thing is, if you look at fundamentally the way that the economy is running and the way that the country has gone, even though the market's been on a tear since the financial crisis, the actual growth in the economy, that, you know, real GDP growth, has been pretty muted. It's been fine. But the term that I use, and that I have, that, you know, economists that we follow use, is called a plow horse. It's not a racehorse economy. It's not running, sprinting, galloping down the road. It's sort of chugging along. And we've been chugging along for quite a while. And despite the fact that Europe has really been dragging the global economy down, despite the fact that China's had some trouble recently, been dragging, and those are big portions of the global economy, the U.S. is still plowing along and plugging along. And I think that that will continue, at least in the near future. And the big takeaway from that is, you need to be invested instead of sitting on the sidelines with all of your money. Now, that doesn't mean you got to put it all to work, and it depends on your individual situation, but there is really just no better way to grow your money right now than investing. There's no better way to keep up with inflation than investing at least a portion of your dollars in the stock market. And over time, you're going to have success that way. And if you have a strategy, that's great. If you don't have a strategy, call your financial advisor. Call us at 503-253-3000. We'll sit down with you. We'll go over our strategy, see if it makes sense for you and might be something you wanted to do. But, you got to have a strategy for taking advantage of the growth, but being ready for the dips. And that brings me up with something I really wanted to talk about as we get towards the end of the year here, is tax loss harvesting. And I'm sure, Kevin, you deal with this a lot in your business. And Taylor, when you're talking to people about how to properly allocate when they have, you know, an estate that they are settling. But if you have losses in your portfolio that have come up over the last year, make sure you're talking to your advisor about how to properly allocate those and net them against some gains. A lot of people don't know that you can harvest those tax losses in your portfolio and write off some of those gains that you might have on the other side. Work in conjunction with your CPA and your advisor. It's a big deal, and it's an underutilized, you know, portion of a lot of people's plan. The other thing is, right, you know, top of mind for people, if you're investing in mutual funds right now, a lot of them are distributing huge capital gains. And a lot of people don't realize that that's actually something you got to pay taxes on this year. Most people think about, hey, I'm investing in the market. I have mutual funds that I bought. I'm not selling them. My advisor told me, as long as I don't sell them, even if they grow, I don't got to pay taxes. And to an extent, that's true, except when they distribute capital gains. And, you know, I got to tell you, I there's so many, you know, you can either be your CPA's best friend or his worst enemy, because he has to dig through these capital gain distributions on an active mutual fund. And that ends up costing money. And you're not in the business of wanting to cost people more money. You want to save their money on taxes and see if you can't keep the cost as low as possible, right, Kevin? And then it's when people like me send them a 1099 that has 15 different line items that you got to dig through and find out, that ends up just running, you know, ching, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
That's exactly right. In fact, I enjoy getting the clients that have brokerage accounts, because when there's a big surprise tax bill at the end of the year, I'm usually pointing my finger at the broker and saying, he made you too much money. He's the enemy.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you know, if we're making money, then we got to pay some taxes on it. But you want to be as smart as possible and talk to your advisor about, do we have any losses that we can harvest in there? Because in that situation, like, your broker made you too much money.
Yep. And you know, that's a good, really good point, Bo. Usually this time of year, if somebody suspects they may have some gain that's in their brokerage account, and again, we're talking regular brokerage accounts, not your deferred accounts.
Yeah, not IRAs. Your IRAs or your 401k or anything like that.
Exactly. That, you know, it usually takes about an hour of time to be able to sit down, review somebody's tax return, and see and get a feel for what might be happening. It's good to hear from you that mutual funds are distributing capital gains this year, because some years they're up, some years they're down. And if we can just estimate a little more on the high side, you know, there can be no surprises. And especially if, you know, like you say, if there's capital losses or maybe a net operating loss from somewhere, sometimes it can come from an estate or what have you, you know, you utilize those losses and deductions. Never leave excess deductions on the table. I know that for sure.
So, right. Yeah. We've talked about it ad nauseum, and I'll repeat it again. I don't mind paying my fair share of taxes. Well, I mean, I don't love it, but I don't, you know, I understand that there's a cost, you know, for having, you know, infrastructure in our cities and our towns and our country and getting keeping the country running, but I don't want to pay more than my fair share. And if you're not paying attention to those loss harvesting ideas, like you said, you know, you could be leaving significant dollars on the table, like, you know, leaving those deductions. That'd be, you know, everybody knows about the mortgage interest deduction. And so they say, well, I would never not deduct that. But if you don't know about capital loss deductions, if you don't know about operating loss deductions, you know, it might be worth a phone call to check that out. To sit down, like you said, an hour of your time and check all that stuff out, right? Yep. And now's the time to start looking at it, because you have to do, if you're going to do those loss harvesting, take those opportunities, you got to do it by the end of the year, right? We got to get it done before the end of the year. So it's kind of top of mind, being that it's almost Thanksgiving. We've got, you know, a little over a month left, and your advisor may be filling up their time, maybe filling up your CPA, their time may be filling up as we get back into the swing of tax season. So pick up the phone and give them a call, or give our office a call if you want a free second opinion.
Well, you love those December 30th phone calls that are like, hey, what do I need to do on my to save on taxes, right?
Right, that's a great one. Yeah, I need to get this done today. Right. I need to get that, you know, remember how we talked 6 months ago about doing this? I need it done today.
Yeah.
Or I need it done yesterday. Yeah, so it's a lot easier. You take a lot of stress off of your broker, off of your CPA, if you call earlier, make the appointment earlier. So, you know, if that's something that's top of mind for you, or you'd like to hear more about it, like us, to take a second look, give our office a call, 503-253-3000. We can sit down with you, or send me an email at bo@pfgwm.com. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back with Cover Your Assets with Taylor Cattell. She's got a segment for you today talking something that's going to be top of mind for a lot of people with your estate planning. But if you have a question specifically about your situation that's been keeping you up at night, give our office or give our show a call, 503-417-9595. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
It's time to learn to cover your assets with Taylor Cattell of KG Law Group. Online at kglawgroup.com. Have a legal question? Call in now at 503-417-9595. Now, here's Taylor Cattell.
Welcome back. This is Taylor Cattell with Covering Your Assets. I want to talk a little bit today about how to talk about your estate plan, but I see we have a question. Barry, you've got a tax question for us.
Yeah, I wanted to ask. It's a kind of a little untraditional question for the tax investigator over there. But anyway, I don't know if you guys are aware, but you probably are, that now they're legal. They had sports betting legalized apps on the in the state of Oregon. So if you win over $600, they're going to send you a slip at the end of the year. Can we? You were talking about harvesting your, you know, bad stocks. Are we able to keep track of our bets on the other side that we don't win and use them to negate the other bets?
Very good question. So you may or may not get if you win over $600, you may or may not get a form. Sports betting has a different set of rules where it has to be, your win has to be over a certain amount over your bet, and so it's...
Well, yeah, no, I already talked to them. They said $600. So if you bet, let's say, $100 and you win $700, then it's $600. I know that's what they told me.
Okay. Yeah, well, we'll see about that, because there's a lot that goes behind that that's a little more, because you do have your other losses throughout the year. And so, I mean, if it's just one bet and the win is over a certain amount, then you may get a 1099. So you will have to report the winnings on your from the 1099 on your tax return. Your gambling losses are the only thing that can specifically offset that those gambling winnings, but it doesn't go directly against that on that same line item. Your gambling losses are taken on your Schedule A, if they're even still allowed anymore. And I'll have to look at that. I think they are on your Schedule A. So you have to be itemizing, first of all, to take your gambling losses.
Yeah, I itemize. I own businesses.
Okay.
I like to do sports betting.
Okay. And
I have one, you know, I don't win all the time, but anyway, I wish. But no, but I mean, I have won some pretty big amounts, and she already told me they're gonna send you something that's, you know, for, they're gonna report it.
Gotcha. So, yeah. So
you also have on the other side of the ledger, I've kept track of the ones that I haven't won.
Yeah. So basically, you know, you've got your $600 that you have to report. You report any of your other gambling winnings, and then your gambling losses are going to go on your Schedule A, not subject to 2%. So hopefully, you're itemizing. And you need a record of all those other gambling losses, and that's how it's going to work. So it's not a great system. If you're winning some money, you're probably going to be paying some taxes on it, because the Schedule A, in your situation, it sounds like you may be able to deduct it, but not everybody. In fact, most people don't itemize anymore. So
right.
Yeah.
So what Barry's probably asking is a little bit of a hypothetically. He's itemizing. All those things work out well. He's got $1,000 of winnings, but that's net winnings. But he has other losses of $500. So hypothetically, would his winnings that he's going to have to claim end up at $500?
He would in his situation, right. It could be $500.
Because
yeah,
you can write off your losses from your net winnings, but not against other.
Right. And you'd want to keep, you know, you go to Vegas and you lose money there. You'd want to keep track of, you know, those losses to net against your other winnings. So
I don't do that, but here it is. But they explain it to me per wager. So, example, if I bet $100 and I win $300, it's not taxable. But if I win $700, then it is.
Yeah. See that. So that
not gross net.
Yeah, I don't know if that's exactly accurate, and maybe that's the way they're going to do it. But you go down to Vegas and you bet $100 and, you know, on a parlay, and you win $1,000, you don't get a 1099 down there. So I don't know how Oregon's going to.
I think on the tables there is a certain limit where they will do something. It's not $1,000, but it's up. I think there is a certain amount on the table they will.
Yeah,
I don't go to Vegas. This is the Oregon sports thing. Sports
Center. Yeah.
The thing is, you see, on the site itself, it keeps track of all your bets.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you have actually, it says my bet slip. It'll show you every bet you've made.
Oh.
So that's going to be an easy part to show your negative bets.
Oh, for sure. That's nice that they are helping you keep track of it, then you don't have to, like, spreadsheet it out later by yourself.
Yeah.
Right. Well, okay. Well, I appreciate it. I mean, I enjoy you guys' show, so keep up the good work. There.
Thank you. Well, you know, keep us posted on, how it goes, you know, because this is pretty new, you know, the sports betting being legalized. And so,
right.
You know, if you wouldn't mind, Barry, keep us posted on when you have to actually do the filing and what your experience has been.
Well, the Oregon Lottery, I called them up. There's a number and there's these people that run it. They're very open to questions and they're very helpful.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Awesome. That's good to hear.
Obviously, they're making money on it for the state.
Right.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. That's a good question. I mean, I know that has come up a lot, you know, when people they're legalizing the betting in Oregon, the sports betting. I did like how you said, I win some. I don't win all the time. And you know, that's a pretty common thing, right? You know?
Yeah, that's right.
As long as you're doing it for entertainment purposes only.
Investment purposes?
Not for investment purposes.
Okay.
Yeah, as long as you're doing it for entertainment purposes only, I don't think there's, you know, there's an issue with it. But, you know, it is worth putting out there just, you know, if you do think you have a problem with gambling, there's a gambling hotline and different things like that to call. But if you're just doing it for fun, like it sounds like Barry's just sports betting for fun, you know, there are ways to, you know, to make sure that you're not paying too much taxes on your winnings, because hopefully you're killing it, right?
That's right.
So, Taylor, you were talking about...
Yeah, how do I transition this? What else is a gamble? It can feel like a gamble to talk to your family about your estate plan. There we go. We mentioned before, we're coming into the holidays, and regardless of whether we were coming into the holidays or not, this is a really important topic of talking to your family about your estate plan, and that cuts both ways. So if you are, say, the older generation and saying, gosh, I should probably communicate to my kids or my stepkids or my brother and sister or whoever it is who's my nearest relative, whoever I'm expecting to pick up any pieces if something were to happen to me, I should probably communicate what I want. If you're not thinking that, maybe you should start thinking that, regardless of how old you are, because anything can happen at any time. And the opposite is true. If you are looking at an older loved one, aunt, uncle, parent, grandparent, whatever it is, and thinking, gosh, I'm going to have to pick up some pieces. I'm not entirely sure what that's going to look like. I'm not entirely sure what they want. I have some general ideas of who maybe they like a little bit more, or do they even have a plan in place? And am I the one named? And it can be awkward. Our culture does not support talking about these subjects. Our culture does not support talking about life support or tube feeding or pulling the plug or all the healthcare stuff that comes along with it. And there's a shift, a generational shift, very clear cut, scientifically documented on comfort talking about money. And so it's interesting because as the boomer generation is looking at their parents who don't talk about money, they are sometimes oversharing about money and reaction, which from my perspective is, if you're going to go one way or the other, oversharing is the way to go, because that communication ahead of time is essential. There's really no other way. Your legal documents are prepared, hopefully by an attorney. They're in legalese, not plain English. And I've struggled with this. Can we make our wills, you know, a little bit more true to ourselves? Can we make it a little bit more personal and authentic so it's not my legal language, but actually your words? And I've come full circle to saying, no, we really can't. Because at the end of the day, it's a legal document for a legal purpose. And I encourage a lot of my clients to write a personal letter, or there's other words for it. Living will is one that's pretty popular. Sometimes it can simply be a spiritual experience where you're sharing what you feel, philosophize about your own life and your accomplishments and what you hope for the future. Or it can simply see this person gets the quilt and this person gets the gun and this person gets the whatever. It really varies on your personality and your level of detail and what your values are. But at the end of the day, communicating with your family in person while you can, it ends up resolving, I would say, this is not scientifically proven, but in my experience, maybe 90% of the family conflicts. And when folks ask me, well, how much does probate cost? How much is a trust administrator? How much am I going to have to pay through my estate when I die? And I said, it depends on how well everybody gets along. We can have it buckled up perfectly, but one person goes astray and they can cost a lot of money to themselves and to others. And how do you control that? Sometimes you can't, right? Sometimes you know you can't. If you know you can't and you can anticipate it, let's plan for that. But if you can't, you're not looking and saying there's this one person who is already asking how much I'm going to get. But instead, you're saying, gosh, my kids get along and I can't possibly fathom that they would have a conflict. Grief does strange things to people and money does strange things to people. And communicate what you want ahead of time and not just about who's going to get what. And you don't have to share everything, but also who's in charge and why. Why is it that you picked the younger of the two? Maybe they're closer. Maybe they just seem a little bit more financially responsible. Maybe you like their spouse more. There's a lot of factors that can be very, very real in how things work. So I truly encourage every single person out there to have and call a formal family meeting. It sounds awkward, but there's a lot of different ways. If you're listening to this now, you can say, hey, I heard this lady on the radio, and she said that it would be a good idea to talk about it. I mean, you can find any way. I read a book, or I did my will recently. I really want to share basic concepts, make sure that everybody's on the same page if anything happens to me. And vice versa, if you're, say, the child in the classic child-parent relationship, I heard this lady on the radio talking about having a family discussion about what you want. I want to make sure that I can follow whatever your wishes are. You don't have to go to mom and dad and say, hey, I want to know how much money you have, and I want to know what my portion's going to be. That obviously is uncomfortable for a lot of good reasons. Maybe your parents choose to share that. Maybe you as the parent choose to share that. That, to me, is 100% up to the family dynamics and the person. And you don't know what you're going to need for your lifetime. So I hesitate in advising my clients on 100% full disclosure in a way that sets expectations.
That's right? A good point. That makes sense.
But that doesn't stop you from saying, it's really important to me that you take care of your kids. I'm not necessarily giving money to the grandkids, but I want you to try to take, if you get anything from me, take anything and maybe put it in a 529 plan. Here's a great financial advisor who you should talk to about what the benefits are and things like that. Or maybe I'm choosing to bypass you kids because you seem fine. And I want to make sure that you don't have the burden of sending my grandkids to college. Right? There's a lot of different values that you can bring to the table depending on what you care about. You don't have to have an attorney to have these discussions. You don't even have to necessarily have an estate plan in place, although it's a good idea to also say, and here are where my key documents are in case anything happens to me. Here's who has authority to access them, things like that. So it's really, I read a book that there's not a sponsor or anything like that, but it's called Being Mortal, and I recommend it all the time. And it is from a doctor's perspective on end of life decisions. And it's very well written, very accessible, very interesting in the history of long-term care actually being here in Portland. So some interesting historical piece to that, too. But he talks about his clients, or his patients, and he talks about his own parents. And you can't help but read that book and think, what does quality of life mean to me? And do the people around me know and understand that? It was enough to motivate me to call a family meeting, which I did. And my sister said, why would we do that? and my parents said, gosh, okay, it's a little bit uncomfortable. You know, we've done our estate plan and so forth. I said, well, I really want to. And this was a couple years back. And we all sat down around the table. And I said, this is why I want us to hear the same thing from mom and dad. Mom, you always say, somewhat jokingly, when you hear a story about someone at church who's quote unquote off their rocker, and you say, just put me in a home. Are you joking? Or is that real? Would you expect us to have you move in? Would you expect us to buy a bigger house? Do you really want to live in a community? Like, at what point would that be your choice? And so for her to be able to say, no, I mean that. I don't want to be a burden on you. We're hopefully saving enough to pay for it, whatever it is. For both my sister and I to hear that at the same time, in the same context, I'm happy to say my mother is alive and well, but we both know at what point we would need to collaborate and figure that out. So anyway, it's a really interesting, I'm curious if you guys have conversations with your clients, because it can dovetail, right? How do you communicate, and to what extent do you share with your family this information?
Yeah, I mean, the big hurdle for a lot of folks is, like you said, they don't want to set expectations about what mm-hmm. they're going to get, but then you don't think about, you know, a big hurdle, you know, that I push back on is, I'm dead, who cares,
right?
You know,
right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a talking point for a different day, right? But, you know, when you go into it thinking, like in your situation, your mom has two daughters and you guys get along and you love each other, but then if you hadn't had this conversation about no mom, you know, because your sister may have not had that conversation with mom about put me in a home, and you did, and then mom has, heaven forbid, you know, knocking on wood as I say this, that she is diagnosed with dementia, right? Mm-hmm. Which happens. I feel like it happens to us if we live long enough, right?
Right, and a lot more people are living a lot longer.
Right, living a lot longer. And so then she is at a point where then your sister said, well, no, I don't want mom to be in home. She would never want to go into a memory care facility. And you say, well, no, but she told me. But having the conversation about, no, this is actually what I want, when she's able to have that conversation is huge. But it, you know, the other thing is, your kids may not know where your stuff is.
Right.
Right. So
just the practicalities of it, and things, especially I'm hearing a lot from folks who have passed away. I can't access their phone, and that's where all their photos are. All I need to do is put together the slideshow for the memorial. I'm not trying to break into their private information, but with privacy rights as strong as they are, which I'm not opposed to, while we're alive and able to restrict that, that's carrying over into the deceased. And so, yes, there are some legal ways, and there's been some new developments in the law trying to give access to quote-unquote digital assets, which is not just things of value, but can be of value. It's mostly sentimental value from what I see day in, day out. But the law is so far behind our real world and the practical access. You're not going to call Apple. How do you call Gmail and say all of the accounts were on electronic auto pay and I can't access, you know, I just want to make sure the lights stay on? That communication, making sure somebody can find your passwords that are important or get into your photos, where are they, where are they kept, is critical. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that's, you know, so if you learn nothing else, talk to your family, right? Call everybody, go out and call a family meeting right now, as uncomfortable as it might be, but just make sure everybody's on the same page, right?
And it can be uncomfortable. One of my goals, and I'll share this freely, was that I thought I should be the trustee of my parents' trust.
Sure.
Right? They made my sister, as the older sister, the trustee. Well, that was many, many years ago. And now I do this for a living. And my sister is closer, but she also gets more stressed and won't delegate. And I'm very comfortable with delegating. So I said, I think I should be the trustee because I know that I will involve my sister. I will have to because of her proximity. Mm-hmm. But I will be able to do the legal piece and work with her on other specific situations. Now, that was uncomfortable, right, for me to say to my parents in front of my sister, I think I should be the one to do it, but here's why. And my sister listened, and she said, I completely agree. I would be so stressed out if it was all on me and you'd be up in Portland and I don't know how I would feel like you could step in without flying down and so forth. So it ended up being a really healthy conversation. I'm lucky to have a family that I can talk that frankly, and I didn't say it quite like that either. I mean, there was more softness in that, but it can be tough and uncomfortable. And in the end of the day, it can be really, really fulfilling and rewarding.
Yeah. It takes a lot of that stress off, takes the burden off of, no, you know, not knowing whether your wishes are going to be followed.
Right? Absolutely.
So we're going to take a quick break here and come back with the tax investigators. Kevin's got some stuff that we teased last week to hear about investment-wise. But if you have a question specifically for Taylor about approaches to your family, different reasons why that makes sense to have that conversation, if you have questions specifically about your tax situation or about investments or just the market in general, something that's been keeping you up at night, pick up the phone, give us a call, 503-
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve. Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you're reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help. If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.
Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin, 503-417-9595, or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. Great segment there, Taylor. I'm kind of a numbers guy, so that was all a little ethereal for me, but good stuff. One of the things I've learned in accounting from those who have gone before me and mentored me is a lot of what I do actually is therapy, mm-hmm. and not numbers and taxes, but mm-hmm. it's listening and just you know, real world talking about things. And you know, in this situation that you just described, just this last week, I had a friend tell me a particular estate plan that their family had put into place, and at the end of it, it was just like, the friend is going to be in a very tough position with the other siblings mm-hmm. or sibling in this case that does not spend money well. And for some reason, the parent felt needed to be protected from having a lump sum come into their life upon the passing of the parent.
Oh.
And the other sibling is going to have to manage this. And I just said, yeah, the handwriting's on the wall. It's going to be a tough situation for you.
There are options.
This is true.
For your friend, just putting it out there if he's, you know, and he doesn't necessarily have to address it now.
Yep.
You can decline to serve. You can nominate a successor professional if you don't want that relationship with your sibling, which is very common. A lot of parents think, well, who would manage the money better than your own brother? And from my direct experience, a lot of people would manage the money a lot better than your own brother. Not for any dig on the manager or the trustee, but simply that relationship impact and being the one who holds the purse strings can be really much better to have someone else. So you're saying, gosh, I'm so sorry that they're doing that to you, brother.
Yep. That's a very good point. And kind of knowing the options that are out there.
Yeah.
So they were looking to get in touch with somebody to advise them further.
Yeah.
So that is good. Well, today on the Tax Investigator, I want to talk about, and we've briefly talked about this before a number of months back, but the IRS has come up with some guidance that is pretty tight, and it's on what's called a listed transaction. And I know that some people listening to us have partaken of these transactions. I'm not necessarily saying it was a bad thing, but they were aggressive tax planning strategies. And in this case, this one is called it's a conservation easement deduction. And I just generally want to just talk about how it works. So our listeners are informed what's going on and where the enforcement is being looked at. And in general, how these transactions work is you've got a landowner, and he or she has a bunch of acreage. We'll say 1,000 acres, and it's worth we'll say $5 million, but they embark upon this strategy of a conservation easement. They basically go out, they get the zoning reworked, and now they can develop this scrubland, if you will. And now this land is worth $100 million to be developed. Well, they actually had no intention to develop it. They just wanted the increase in highest and best use value of this land. So what they would do is they would contribute this land into a publicly traded partnership that they own fully. It's worth $100 million, and now they are going to contribute it to conservation purposes. They donate it to They don't donate the land. They donate the use of the land. It cannot be developed now. And so now the land value drops back down to, you know, $5 million, we'll say. So it was they just got it $100 million at highest and best use. It's now worth $5 million with this restriction on it. So now there's a $95 million deduction in this plot of land that they've contributed to a partnership, which they fully own. And this partnership's not going to make any money. It just has this piece of asset. And so investors, our listeners, taxpayers, the people I come in contact with, I don't deal with the segment I just talked about. I deal with the people that buy into this publicly traded partnership. They buy into it, say $20,000. Mm-hmm. They have bought themselves, and there's only a certain number of investors that are that this partnership is going to take to make the numbers work. They buy in for $20,000. They're typically buying a charitable contribution of $80,000 to $100,000 to put on their tax return. And so you can see, especially for high income taxpayers, a $100,000 deduction at, say, 35% federal, 9%, you're 42%. You just $20,000, you just save $42,000 in taxes. Right. So you can see. You can see where the IRS is not real happy with this. Number one, problems happen in the valuation. Uh-huh. Inflated, instead of $100 million, well, let's make it $150 million. You find the right appraiser, you know, and so there's issues there. So the IRS has seen these coming down the line, and a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, they made it a listed transaction, which means if you were an investor or a taxpayer who bought into one of these conservation green partnerships, as we call them, then you have to fill out another form. You're disclosing it to the IRS, this particular transaction, and there is information ad nauseum that has to be provided. Usually when you buy into this investment, they provide you, if it's a good company that was trying to do this on the up and up, it's a, it's an aggressive strategy, but it was legal, they would provide you with documentation ad nauseum to do this listed transaction disclosure on your tax return. Now it's getting to the point where the IRS is saying these aren't legal. We're not going down this road. It's not appropriate. And so they issued a notice that basically says, I shouldn't say it's not legal. They're saying they're going to audit these. They're going to go after them hard, and then you're going to have to go to court to determine if this was a good, you know, position or not, if it was legal or not. So they're saying if in an open tax year you are to amend your tax return and take this transaction off of your tax return, they will not assess penalty and interest. So you'll just pay the tax that this would have saved you.
Right.
So you're rolling the dice. Are you gonna wait to see if the IRS, if you're big enough fish for them to track you down and audit this transaction on your return and then try to fight it in court? If you lose, they're assessing a 20 to 40% penalty on top of the tax. So it's
what you should have paid.
In fact, the article I read said if it was $100 in tax savings, and we'll just take an average of 30% penalty, you would actually owe $130. So there's a 100% penalty in there. Sounds like
well
the tax plus
you pay
the 30,
tax plus, yeah, the penalty.
Plus the penalty.
How far back are they? Could they look?
Well, closed tax years theoretically are go back 3 years. I don't think they can say that there's fraud in this, but you just never know what position they take. Technically, they can only go back 3 years to the open tax years. But if they felt there was fraud at any level, the statute is never closed. I don't think our people buying into this have a fraudulent intent.
Right.
Or you don't know the numbers of the investment you're buying in. You didn't know if the appraisal was fraudulent. But, you know, it's
going to cost money to parse that out and prove it. So there goes some of your tax savings at least.
Right. At least just in the fighting of it.
I mean, exactly.
That getting a private letter ruling is almost like probate, where it's just you're spending a ton of money to.
Exactly right.
But about six times.
So if you're in a green partnership, if you've done a conservation easement transaction, if you haven't put it down as a listed transaction, you've messed up right there, but hopefully you have. And now you have got a decision to make. Are you going to change your open years, or are you going to just, you know, let it go? And of course, this was just a notice that the IRS sent out. So, you know, it's a tough call. So that's just wanted to bring that issue.
Yeah.
To
so life. If you're listening, you've had one of those, or you know, and you have a question about that, I mean, they should give your office. You guys are working on this in your office. Like, you can help. Not advise on whether or not to list it, because obviously right. Your advice is always
sure.
Disclose it to the IRS.
Yeah.
But if it, you know, did you have a lot of experience in handling?
I've done these. Yeah. I've done these. I can't say that I want to be the one to take it to court.
To court, yeah. No. But if they're calling you to help amend and fix and say, hey, we've got to, you know, go back on this, that's something that you guys can do in an open tax year, like you said.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Sometimes at this level, depending on your dollar amount, you may want the protection of a tax attorney.
Oh, sure.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yep. And that's a tax investigator for today.
I like it. That's good. Yeah, that's, you know, so that's if you're in a green partnership, you're exploring it, it's definitely worth kicking the tires around and making sure that the numbers are on the up and up and that sort of thing.
And undoubtedly, there's going to be some people on the business side that have done the valuations and created the green partnerships, there's undoubtedly going to be some people getting hit.
Going to be some other lawsuits going around there
pretty
for
hard,
sure.
Maybe even some hard time for the aggressive ones that have gone above and beyond.
A lot of that for me is really coming back to a theme of our show, which is trust your advisors also, and be, if it's too good to be true, it might be not true. And that's really, it's hard sometimes. And I have clients who come in and say, hey, I can, you know, someone told me, whether it was another lawyer or a friend or a friend's lawyer or whatever they're interpreting, I could do this and avoid probate. Well, that might be too good to be true, or right. That might be. And I think that probably happens even more often on the tax side and on the investing side.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, and especially I get it from, you know, where I have the conversation of, hey, I'm not a CPA, because I'm not, right? I know enough to be dangerous about taxes, right? So I tell people, I know, you know, let's make sure we call your CPA. But I'll have things where people say, well, my CPA, you know, or my accountant said I could do this. And I'm like, I mean, is that right?
Exactly.
You know, just because, and I don't know if, and again, the people will say, hey, my CPA said this, and then you kind of dig deeper and it's, oh no, my CPA didn't say that. My friend said his CPA said it. And then if you actually call the CPA, the CPA goes, no, I didn't say that.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of times you hear what you want to hear in those situations. But the big thing it comes back to, right, if it sounds too good to be true, it might be. Uh-huh. If you make money, you owe taxes on it, right? It just, you know, there's ways you can be smart about it. You can be smart about taxes. You can be smart about estate planning. But if you pass away and you have stuff, it's got to go, you know, there's a legal process that it's got to go through, right?
Right.
You can't just napkin it out and say, hey, I want Johnny to get the, you know, the old vase. You know, you need to
have it. I mean, you can, it's just not going to happen. Right. And that's the problem, right? People think, well, I even had a friend send me a text. Who I am also his estate planning attorney, sent me a text and said, I'm on a plane. This is what I want to change. And I wrote him back because I didn't get it until, you know, and I wrote him back. I said, I sure hope you landed because that's not legal.
Oh, wow.
I appreciate that you want to keep me informed. Let's meet next week and we can change your documents, but right. I hope you made it safe.
That's pretty
and
funny.
He did. But it's, you know, even when I've had the educational moments with my clients and explained, hey, if you want to make any changes, it's got to be double witnessed, and those witnesses have to have a notarized affidavit to say this was valid. You know, Oregon is very strict. They've loosened it in the slightest bit. But historically, Oregon is one of the most strict states on following the formalities of will execution. And that's something that a lot of people really take lightly.
Yeah.
And it costs quite a bit in the end.
Two witnessed signatures on a will?
So when you sign a will, there have to be two disinterested witnesses.
Okay.
So you can't just sit down with your spouse and sign each other's, right? Which happens. Or you can't have your kids just come over. It needs to be someone who's not going to inherit, somebody who's not couldn't potentially inherit. It can be your attorney, and maybe like what I do is myself and a paralegal. Sometimes I have both paralegals if I need to be more independent, if it's a little bit more questionable. But that's a really important step because I'm in the middle of a contest right now where I'm representing somebody whose rights were affected and they can't speak up for themselves. And it was a deathbed change, right? And so did she have capacity to make that change? And I'm digging into, did she, didn't she? What are the facts and where does this go? And I'm thinking, you know, if there had just been two more people right. in the room who could tell me this is what she said right before she signed, my case would be over, right? This right. would be very simple. And so anytime you have multiple witnesses, you really are protecting your plan. And that's part of doing it right with an attorney is that they know this and they know the context of it. But it has to be two witnesses that are disinterested. But then there's always an affidavit that has to be attached to the will. And both witnesses sign that, and that's what's notarized, saying that we were the witnesses of the will. This person had capacity. They were not subject to undue influence. Everything is generally right and legal about this document. And that's something that the person who's signing doesn't have to see or do. But if you don't have that affidavit, you have to physically track down those witnesses to prove the validity of the will. So it's hard. A lot of witness affidavits don't even have their name printed. So you're literally looking at a signature, looking at the notary block and thinking, huh, I wonder if I can find them by their notary commission. I hope they took it in there. But, you know, it can be very hard to track down.
Right.
And in other states, it can be even harder. In Oregon, you can probate a copy under certain circumstances. And Washington, much more difficult. Hmm. So there are a lot of formalities. It's really quite boring. But if you do it right, it's supposed to be boring.
Well, yeah, boring is, you know, you're playing it fast. It is, you know, it can, like you said, if you do it right, then it's boring and easy. It's not.
Exactly. And that's what you want.
The excitement comes from you know, having it done wrong, I suppose, although not good excitement.
Exactly.
Right? Scary excitement. So, you know, I only have a couple minutes left. So quickly, I had a question come up and I thought I answered it right. But, you know, I had a client that asked it when, and maybe you can talk, generally speaking, but when should you get your estate plan done?
Okay. Any and every time.
That's what I said. Yeah.
There is never a time. I have a lot of folks who say, oh, I'm so simple. I don't have any kids, everything. And I'm thinking, actually, if you don't fit that standard, you know, Oregon has a plan for you. It's going to go the way it's going to go. And if you want it to be different or if you want it to cost less, then you have to have your own estate plan. But even in situations that my classic yellow flag is I have a simple plan. Because right. almost inevitably, it's not simple.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And it could be, if you don't get it set up, then it ends up costing a lot more, right? That's
exactly
the big thing. And so, what you're saying is, if you're thinking about it, if you've talked about it, go do it. Right?
The most common times that people think about it is, I just had a child. Mm-hmm. I should protect something for them, and that's true. Absolutely. If you have anybody under 18 who would benefit from your estate. Child, grandchild, niece, nephew, whoever you want, that's really, really important to have a plan and a trust set up for that minor. A lot of other folks think about it at retirement, which makes sense because that's a massive shift financially in their life and they're looking ahead and saying, what do I want? And then once a spouse has died or when something else has happened. But at any point, it's really, really important.
That makes sense to me. I think that's basically the answer I gave was yeah. now.
Now is the best time.
Yeah, now call. here's Taylor's card. Here, now is the time to do it.
Yep.
So Taylor, people have heard you. They're listening. Now is the time to do it. How do they get a hold of you?
Great. Taylor Cattell with KG Law Group. You can find us online at kglawgroup.com. You can call us at 503-878-8948.
Perfect. And Kevin, if people have that question about a green space or they want to get their taxes done or get started early, how do they get a hold of you?
We are at baker-colson.com and our phone number is 503-666-5569.
Perfect. And at Price Financial Group, we're at pfgwm.com, 503-253-3000, or send me an email at bo@pfgwm.com. You can also go on and sign up for our newsletter. We send that out every week with updates on the market and different things we're doing. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for Investing Simplified. God bless you and have a great day.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.
Navigating through today's financial investment world can seem pretty scary. Now, here's the good news.
Chuck Price, president of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, introduces a new revolutionary concept that will change how you invest now and in the future. It's called Asset Lock. Asset Lock monitors your investment accounts 24/7, 365, and alerts you when action needs to be taken. And now, Chuck Price offers Asset Lock. At Price Financial Group Wealth Management, we believe all our clients deserve to have Asset Lock monitoring their accounts. So call Chuck today or online at pfgwm.com and learn how you can get Asset Lock on your accounts today for free. Price Financial Group Wealth Management, because the smart investor knows what you don't know can't hurt you.
Investing Simplified.
Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.